But you know, all of that work for the military, which is, of course, in Vietnam that was a full-time job, but otherwise it's been pretty much half-time. You don't get any credit for that in the academic circles. And yet, it was this kind of work over the years, not just by me, but by a lot of people, that caused the demise of the Soviet Union and made it so that all the rest of these academics can live in their ivory towers if you don't get any credit for it.
Well, I mean, I thought about that in looking at your publication list, which is shorter than what most academics would have, and it's obvious that your time and energies were often spent on things that would never see the light of day.
Right.
But in many respects, were probably equal to anything published in the scientific journals. How did you feel about that?
Well, I made the decision, you know, to live with it. It's something of a sacrifice if your main goal is to achieve outstanding academic recognition. But the way things are.
Well, you did receive recognition from some quarters in the military, at least.
Yeah, and with those and a dollar bill, you can probably buy a beer, you know.
What kind of a person was Westmoreland? You commented generally about him before, but...
Well, he's very bright. He's, of course, very dedicated. He's a real gentleman of the old school. He's pays a lot of attention to physical fitness. He spent a great deal of time with the troops out in the field visiting them. I used to go around occasionally with him with some visits on the units. I was sort of appalled when I first got out there. I was treated very well in the sense that at any meeting I sat at the head table and so on. We had a weekly, what was called a weekly intelligence estimates update, the WOO. It met at 7 a.m. Saturday morning and ran most of the day. And in the headquarters place, there was a U-shaped table like this with the briefers sitting on the sides and the charts and blackboards and up there. Westy sat here, and then the lesser ranks down the table. I had the what was called the assimilated rank of lieutenant general, so I was usually sitting here, and there'd be Spike Momeyer, the 7th Air Force, here, and then the Army guy over here, and so on down the line. And when I first got out there, I was bothered that there was almost no discussion. I mean, a very different kind of atmosphere in which briefers would give their briefing and Westy would comment, or the various staff members would make their proposals and Westy would approve or disapprove or comment or whatnot. No discussion. So after I'd been there about 3 weeks and felt that I was getting to know Westy, approached the subject, I asked him. I just pointed out the difference from the climate you'd find in a university. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I'm worried about that too. He says, when Bill DePue was here, he says, there used to be a lot of discussion. He said, let me see what I can do about that. See, this kind of receptivity that he had, which I really admire. Well, the next time, the next week, he gave them a little speech. He said, I want to tell you what about my overall strategy, and then I want your comments on it. Don't sit there like a bunch of lumps on a log. And he went through like a schoolmaster with maps, you know, and he reviewed the history and reviewed what the problems were and what his intentions were and so on. Beautiful. And from that point on, there was a fair amount of discussion. So I never felt inhibited, although, you know, in any case, I would not try to put myself forward because, you know, take a back seat to the military, let them do their thing. And, you know, if there was something scientific came up that I knew something special about, that I would point out. Well, an example, there was this McNamara barrier that was just going to be installed, that is, the air-delivered sensors were just about to be dropped. And the plan was to, the infiltration trails were over here in Laos, the Ho Chi Minh Trail, was to drop these sensors over there, okay? And this was under discussion. And this was just when Khe Sanh was beginning to undergo siege. And there were four divisions around here going to gobble that up. And so at the end of this session, Westy would always go around the table if you got any comments. So at that invitation, I said, I'd like to suggest that because of this siege of Khe Sanh, let's pick up that operation we call Niagara. Pick it up and move it around Khe Sanh, where the action is, and use that to target all those investing troops. Well, Spike Momeyer was sitting next to me, and he says, I got it, he was riding a Twix to do that to the NKP, the Nakhon Phanom people. So there was a case where I think the scientific advice was good, and it really worked, you know. Mm-hmm. That stopped that siege pretty cold. We could target those guys very easily. In another case, there was a young captain by the name of John Stewart. The country was divided into four core areas, and up here in two core, this was I core. In two core, this is in the tri-border area, that is where Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam come together. This captain had given an intelligence brief on the buildup of forces over here, and it looked like there were 13 battalions of the enemy sitting across the border there. And we had four on this side. So nothing was said about that. And again, at the end of the session, Westy went around the table, and I said, hey, could we call back Captain Stewart and have him review that situation again? That looks like it's an unhealthy ratio. Well, Stewart was sitting on the edge of his chair wanting to do that anyway, so he came back and Westy said, you know, he turned to the COC, the Combat Operations Center officer, and he said, let's move the 173rd up there and get going on it right now. And he told me that night at dinner, he says, we didn't move that up there any too soon. He says, they were attacked this afternoon. But that's the kind of... I have one more story like that. After the big Tet attacks, Westy had told the intelligence staff officer that he'd like an analysis made of that in terms of the potential for a coup. Remember that there are repeated coups there. And the intelligence officer, Phil Davidson, yes sir, you know, he was a two-star. So they did it, and they made their analysis, and they presented it 2 weeks later. This is now 2 or 3 weeks after Tet. But it didn't contain anything resembling a coup. In fact, it was a nutty idea. So, anyway, there was some discussion, and I stuck my neck out. Westy said, "Well, that's fine." He says, "But you, I wanted to see what this looked like in terms of a potential coup." And this thing that always irritated me, the subordinate officer, yes sir, no discussion. Mm-hmm. So I said, "Well, isn't it so that in former coups that these were always concentrated on Saigon, whereas in this case every province capital was attacked?" Westy says, "Yes." "Well, now I'm in for a penny, in for a pound." So I say, "Well, and isn't it so that generally the coup relied on some element of the Vietnamese military who was disaffected to support what they were doing, and that didn't happen this time?" But she said, "Yeah." And by this time I didn't know how to get out of it, so I made a joke. I said, "But," and Wesley was saying, each time he said yes, "but I still want to analyze it." So I said, "Well, I'm always fearful in the intelligence business. We run into a situation that was illustrated in the cartoon Charlie Brown. Charlie Brown, little Lucy is looking at the ground, and Charlie comes up, and Lucy says, 'You see all those bugs there?'" From there, she says, "You see that big black bug? That's the queen." And Charlie Brown looks at it and says, "Ah, that's a jelly bean," and he walks away in disgust. And Lucy looks at it and she says, "Now how did a jelly bean get to be queen?" Well, everybody laughed. Kind of relieved the tension. But the J2, for some reason, was offended. And he says, "Well, I don't know about that, but it doesn't sound very polite," or something like that. And Westy says, "I understand it perfectly." He says, "We mustn't become enamored with our theory." Now there, you see, is a big man. Well, he saved my ass. I later went up and I apologized to Phil. I'm sorry if I embarrass you. Or, oh, I don't know what got into me. No, I think what he said was, at the time, it doesn't sound very respectful.
Oh, okay.
Well, but those are little vignettes of what's more.
Very good ones. Very good ones.
He's a wonderful friend. And there was nobody, I think, that could have done a better job out there, given the political handicaps. If you want to read about that, there's a good book called Strategy for Defeat, written by Admiral Sharp, U.S. Grant Sharp. Strategy for Defeat. You know, President Johnson bragged that we couldn't even bomb an outhouse without his permission. It's a crazy way to run a war. You can't run a war like that. I wrote a little blurb on that. I had to give a talk to the to a symposium of the military R&D people. It was held at West Point on one of my trips back. And I had a graph, and I have all these things here somewhere. The view graph that showed the bombing campaign, you know. Here's the intensity as a function of time, and it goes like this, you know. First you bomb the POL, and they then put all their POL in 55-gallon drums and scatter them along the highway where they need them. And then you bomb the electric power, and you stop and see if they've had enough. And then they haven't, you know, so you resume. Then you hit next the railroad yard, you know, and then something else. And that's adiabatic. If you want to have an effect on something, you got to have a shock wave that goes like that. You know, it's very clear to anybody who knows anything about thermodynamics.
Were the students at UCLA aware of what you were doing, and were there any?
I never had any problem.
The question, but
with them during that the 1970 invasion of Cambodia, there was a student strike, and you know, a lot of the nitwitted faculty went along with that. They didn't know anything either. I'm one of the things I became thoroughly disenchanted with is that scientists, you know, half of them are a bunch of fools, just like ordinary people. And you see that now happening. Get into that, you know, the ozone baloney and the global warming and all that crap, which is, you know, it's a myth. I can tell you about that. But I conducted these classes, my classes, without any interruption, and there was no demonstration or anything. But during that period, a little girl from one of my classes came in and said, "I'd like the assignment." And so I said, "Fine. Why don't you come into class?" She says, "Well, I'm participating in the student strike." So I said, "Why?" So she goes into this. I had a map on my desk of Vietnam. I said, "Let me tell you about that Cambodian thing. These bases right over here, I can't show it here. Base 701, 2, 3, and 4. You would know the name from the intelligence." I said, "What they do is run across the border and zap a village or some of the army, and then run back. It's like playing wood tag, you know, they've got a sanctuary. And it's not we who have enlarged the war. Those are North Vietnamese troops in Cambodia, where they've got no business being. All we did was to go over and clean them out." Well, we talked for a few minutes, and pretty soon she was in tears. The next day she was in class. Mm. I did have a group of students contact me who wanted to stage a counter-demonstration to these strikes. Mm. So I gave them some ammunition for that.
What about some of your faculty colleagues? You comment generally about some of them. Any objection on their part to what you were doing?
Oh, yeah. Not of the kind, not about what I was doing, but the fact that I wasn't full-time at the university. Of course, I was very scrupulous. You know, I was on half-time pay during much of this period.
Okay.
Even when I was chairman.
So the administration had no problem with it. I mean, they were supportive of what you were doing.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, they were even supportive of this defense science seminar. Franklin Murphy was the chancellor at that time, and ran into him at a cocktail party and told him about this thing that was going on. And he says, you know, I said, it seemed to me appropriate for a university that is involved in teaching. You know, we raise up another generation of people knowledgeable in the military problems. And he says, young man, you may get drummed out of the lodge for wanting to do some teaching. No, I didn't have any problem with okay. with anybody in the administration.
Might have been different if you'd been at Columbia at that time.
Yes, that could be. Although that happened quite a bit later. I'm talking about 1963 to 66, okay. and the Columbia business was 1968.
Well, let me follow up on something you just said before, since you said you wanted to talk about ozone and global warming. So why don't we, before we forget it, why don't we talk about that?
Yeah. Let's look at the ozone thing first. And look at the reasons that are advanced in the suspect character. Let's apply our own chemical knowledge to these things, okay? Now, the chlorofluorocarbons are being banned, and that's a big displacement. Not only does it take out of the economy a very useful thing, but it ruptures all the manufacturing. You have to replace all that. Now, where is the ozone hole discovered? At the South Pole. Now, it's well known that the atmospheric communication between the northern and southern hemisphere is very slow. Okay? These CFCs are released in the northern hemisphere, where the industrialization is. And yet they're blamed for that in the south. Now, what is it that's in effect? It's the chlorine atom, not necessarily the molecule, but chlorine. How much chlorine is carried into the atmosphere by water spouts, you know, little hurricanes on the ocean, or spewed out of volcanoes? Like a factor 500 times the chlorofluorocarbons integrated over all time, you know? I mean, the amount spewed out of Mount Pinatubo dwarfs that. So how can you say that the chlorine comes from the chlorofluorocarbons? That's point number one. The second point is that how do you get ozone in the first place? Well, you've got O2 plus a photon to give two oxygens, and then you have an interaction with a third body to give ozone, right? Mm-hmm. So the fundamental step involves solar radiation. Where is the solar radiation dim? At the poles, of course. You know, because it comes in at a glancing angle. So it's not a question of chewing up the ozone, it's a question of making it in the first place. And nobody addresses these issues. It seems to me just insane to formulate a national policy, particularly one that costs big bucks and disruption of the industry, on the basis of this kind of poor science. And I've heard Sherry Rowland talk about this. I asked him about how do you know the chlorine comes from it? He gives a waffling answer. How does the amount of chlorine compare with what's naturally produced? He doesn't know, but he cites numbers like concentrations of 10 to the minus 12 or some damn thing. Now, if you look at the global warming, that's in the same kind of a boat. The thing that people ignore there is that when you raise the temperature slightly, the number of cloud area increases. That greatly increases the albedo, the reflectivity of the planet, and so you get a compensating effect. In other words, natural processes are not balanced on a knife edge. They never could be what they are if they were. There are all kinds of buffer systems that interact. So,
but it makes very good press, doesn't it?
Well, Yeah, I suppose. Do you know of, you ever hear of a guy by the name of Peter Beckman? Then I have to introduce you to this.
Okay.
I don't know how your time is going. I have lots of time.
I do too.
And I'm having fun.
Okay, we'll keep going.
Maybe you'd like to take a
pit stop break.
No, maybe, I guess.
okay. These are two things. This is Accuracy in Media by a guy by the name of Reed Irvine. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No.
And this is a little sheet put out by Peter Beckman, who is a retired electrical engineer at University of Colorado. And both of these happen to discuss this global warming thing.
Okay.
And in this one, he quotes a statement put out by a whole group of scientists saying, in effect, you know, that the data just doesn't support what's being said. And here's a list of people that signed that. Mm. And, you know, they're all pretty prestigious people. Let's take a break, and while we're doing that, I'll get these copied for you.
Okay, great.